Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon and an odd day. Lots of stuff going on. And I got a phone call. Actually, I got a text message this afternoon. And my daughter has begun college. And I think I've mentioned that her philosophy professor, very loud out there, Rich, thank you very much. Wouldn't matter if there was, like, inflation around the door, but there really isn't. So, anyway, one of these days, yeah, before 2010. This fellow is like moveon.org with an attitude, okay? I wasn't aware of the fact that you could, like, spend money to take a class and just get nothing but indoctrination and ultra-leftist politics, but that basically is what going to college anymore is about. And So we've talked about some of the things that he's said, and she's attempted to engage some of the things that he's said in class. But I guess today was a really unusual day, and I know this. She's now experienced something in her life that I didn't experience in mine. But I guess he was on the roll today. He was ranting and raving about how they had gone after Clinton over sexual peccadilloes, and yet they won't go after Bush for being a murderer and killing thousands of people and being a war criminal and all the rest of this wacky stuff. And Yogi Bear and Channel just said, I think I had the same guy at community college. He dips around. You may have. It does seem to be a cloned type of a thing. But then he started going after the Bible and women. Now, my daughter has been raised at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. And say what you will about little PRBC. Unless you are comatose, being raised there in the Sunday school classes, she has had a number of really good teachers over the years. She's had teacher Diana and Mr. Flock, and then she's had Mr. Escobedo and Mr. Smith and Mr. Porter and Mr. Broyles and Mr. Callahan, and they all share one thing in common, and that is that they teach. They don't just sit there and entertain. They teach. And she's also been to a number of my debates. She's been on some of our cruises. She's been to a lot of the conferences that we've done. Some of you have met her. And while she has never expressed interest in becoming a professional apologist or something, she has grown up in my home. And so when he starts saying that, well, if anybody really believed the Bible, they'd be stoning prostitutes and blah, 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 she is like, wait a minute. This is basic Christianity 101 here, and obviously this guy has no idea what Christianity 101's about. So anyway, she tries to begin to engage this. Now, I go back a step, and she told me at the beginning of the class that he was constantly saying that if you folks don't engage the topics and that you can disagree with me and if you don't talk about these things, then this is going to be boring for all of us and blah, 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 blah. Well, that's true, basically, as long as you're not a Christian. And so basically, he he lost it. He started yelling at her, and she couldn't get a word in edgewise, and he's cutting her off, and he's losing it, and other people in the class are putting their hands up going, hey, wait a minute, dude, can she get a word in edgewise? I'd like to hear what she has to say type of a situation. I mean, there is sort of a class rebellion going on. Because he is going on, the Bible doesn't say anything about abortion and blah, 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 blah. And I guess finally, at one point, he's going, look, I'll tell you what, you go home and you Google the author of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You come back and tell me who wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. As if Google is the, you know, way of getting all knowledge. And I'm sitting here, you know, she's telling me this on the phone later on. And, she, you know, and give her credit. I, you know, honestly, I wouldn't have done this. But after the class is over, she actually went up to him and said to him, "I, you know, we may disagree, but I want you to know that I respect you." She actually offered her hand to shake this guy's hand. And you know what he does? Only thing he says back to her is, Google who wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You tell me. Oh, by the way, he says, I'll give you $100 if you can tell me who wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so I'm listening to this just going, my goodness, can you imagine if any professor did this about the Quran and Muhammad today, how fast they would be bounced right out of academia? It's amazing. But hey, as long as it's Christianity, everything is fair game. And that's just simply how it works. And so I am contemplating writing an open letter to this professor and posting it on my blog and sending the URL to his email address, which is publicly available. So that he is aware of the fact that there has been a response offered to him. And I can guarantee you one thing. I'm one papa that's going to be looking very closely at the grade that is given in this class because, there was a time when we'd hear about how Christians would be abused in other lands and they would not be given the appropriate you know, grades for classes and not allowed to progress in society, et cetera, et cetera. Now it's happened right here in the good old U.S. of A. And there are books out there. I know that Rush Limbaugh's brother, David Limbaugh, put out a book on the persecution of Christians. And I think that that kind of thing is going to be something we'll be talking about much more in the future as well, unfortunately. But we will see. If you see a open letter appearing on my blog over the weekend to a certain professor in the Glendale Phoenix area of Arizona, you, now you know what the background is. So I tell you, I think back on my own youth and what I was able to do in a public school system. I was class valedictorian of both my junior high school and my high school. And in both of those speeches that I gave, I was able to mention the name of Jesus Christ and refer to him as my Savior and things like that. And I, you know, things have changed. Things have changed a lot in the past 25, 30 years since that was the case. And something tells me any Muslim on the planet that was a in the United States anyways, that was class valedictorian would get to say anything they jolly well wanted to say. They could talk about Muhammad, and they could quote the Quran, and everything would be fine as long as they didn't wear a burqa. But I tell you, the West is absolutely intent upon self-destruction. There is no two ways about it. So anyhow, 877-753-3341 is the phone number, 877-753-3341. That's the number that Stephen has already called. Let's talk with Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, James. How you doing?
Doing good.
I got a question for you concerning the passage of Scripture, John 1:1 in particular, Part C.
Okay.
Could you explain the finer parts of the Greek grammar concerning the structure of the sentence and how it implies that Jesus is equal with God the Father, and what it would mean if the word order were reversed, where Logos was first and Theos was second.
Well, a couple things. There are a number of articles. There's an article on aomin.org on this subject. There's an entire chapter in The Forgotten Trinity for those who have those resources. If reading this material, having that information available to you would be useful.
Yep.
In the context of a phone call, it would not the word order is not the issue. The issue in the third clause of John 1:1 has to do with which of the two nominative nouns has the article in front of it.
Yep.
So let's back that up just a little bit so that people understand what we're talking about. When someone says John 1:1c, what they're referring to is the fact that John 1:1 has three clauses. The first clause is NRK in halagos, in the beginning was the word. The second clause, or clause B, would be and kai halagos ein proston theon, and the word was with God. And then John 1:1c is kai theos ein halagos. And what most people are probably aware of, though it's been quite some time since we discussed this on the program, so I want to give some background information. We don't want to lose everybody, have everybody tuning off to, well, whatever else you turn off to on the internet. But anyway, going over to YouTube and watching some stupid video or something. The issue for most people, their familiarity with this subject comes from the fact that the Jehovah's Witnesses New World Translation renders the last clause of John 1:1, the word was a God, a small g God. And so there is a lot of discussion that goes on concerning how you are to translate and what's called an anarthrous predicate nominative. Now let's, if you can put your thinking caps on, remember back to when you covered grammar in school. You know that there are parts of speech, and nouns can take various forms and various functions within a sentence. And in the Greek language, those nouns will take different forms depending on how they're functioning. There is something called a predicate nominative. There is such a thing in English as a predicate nominative as well. And in fact, I remember a very strict English teacher in 7th and 8th grade that I, at the time, was very thankful I avoided, except for one class I had to have her, and I remember her drilling it into my brain, predicate nouns follow linking verbs. The predicate nouns follow linking verbs. I remember it to this day. And, of course, since then, I've wished that I had had her for the whole year, because my grammar would not be a patchwork quilt of German and Greek and Hebrew, rather than it would be actually English grammar. Anyway, you have linking verbs, or in this case, the Greek verb eimi, in the Greek language as well, and it is found in the imperfect form in the third clause of John 1:1. In fact, it's found in each of the clauses of John 1:1, translated in most English translations by the word was. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. Now, the terms God and Logos. Now, in English, we have and the word was God. And generally in English, you indicate the subject by putting it first, then the verb second, and then other complements, predicate nominatives, adjectives, so on and so forth down the line. In Greek, you don't do it necessarily that way. Word order does not function the same way in Greek as it does in English. Instead, you have something called the Greek article. And the Greek article is very, 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 very roughly equivalent to the word the, but I emphasized very because the Greek article is far beyond anything that the English article could ever aspire to be. The word the just doesn't, you know, doesn't even come close. And the rule that you have in the Greek language is that the noun, the nominative noun, there's different cases in the Greek language. And in Greek, you have, depending on which grammar you learn from, five or eight. By form, you have five. By function, you have at least eight. Nominative, genitive, ablative, locative, instrumental, dative, accusative, and vocative in the eight-case system. But the genitive and ablative have the same form. The locative, instrumental, and dative have the same form. And so you can squish them down to a smaller number in the other grammars that you would use. Be that as it may, the nominatives, there are two nominatives in John 1:1c. And they are theos, which means God, and logos, which means word. Now, the if you were listening, you noticed that the third phrase is Kai Theos Ein Ha Logos, and Logos comes last, but there is a word Ha that appears before the term Logos. That is the definite article Ha, the word the. And the rule is that a nominative noun that has the article, and if you have the word I, me, or ginamai, the linking verbs, as my eighth grade teacher pounded into our heads, if you have those verbs, then if one of the nominatives has the article and the other one does not, then the one with the article is the subject and the one without is the predicate nominative. Hence, the appropriate translation, the word was God. Now, most of the argumentation then comes around whether you should translate that the word was God, capital G-O-D, or a God, A-G-O-D, as if it is somehow indefinite. And one of the problems is that you will talk to Jehovah's Witnesses, and what they will say to you is that, well, if you don't have, if the article was there, then it would be the God. The problem is, if the last phrase of John 1:1 said, Kai ha theos, ein ha logos, if both nominatives had the article, or if it said, Kai theos, ein logos, neither nominative has the article, then you would not only not know what the subject was, in essence, the language would be expressing equality between the two terms. That is, that they are interchangeable. And most often, the example that is used of where this would cause tremendous difficulty is when you look at 1 John and you see John's statement, God is love. It would not be appropriate, because of the use of the article there, to translate it as love is God. And love and God are not interchangeable concepts. And despite what some people might think, they are not interchangeable concepts. And logos and God are not interchangeable concepts as they're being used in this particular text. And so if the article was there, as many Jehovah's Witnesses would demand that it needs to be there, even though in the vast majority of instances where the New World Translation renders the term God, capital G-O-D, the word God does not have the article. In fact, as I recall correctly, 94% of the time that's the case, and they do not insist upon translating as a God in those contexts. They don't even follow their own rule. But if it had the article, then this would be a very confusing text indeed, because what it would say is, we go back to 1:1a, in the beginning was the word. The imperfect form of I, me does not point to a point in origin. It does not say, at this point in time, the word came into existence. One of the things we need to note is that in the prologue of John 1:1-18, there is a very specific use of the verbs, I, me, or ein, the imperfect form, and then a genita is used of everything else that's created. So when it says everything else came into existence, it uses the genita, and that's in the aorist. It's pointing to a point of time and origin. That's not used of the logos. That's not used of the word. Were you trying to make a comment?
It just seems like Greg Stafford puts up such this fight about, I understand what you're saying with the article. By the way, I am a full, hardcore, 100% Trinitarian. I'm just trying to see where the,
where
the chink in his armor is.
Well, okay.
His argument.
Yeah, well, his argument, let me first finish this for the folks who may not really care about Greg Stafford, and then we can talk about mass and count nouns, and I can direct you to the more in-depth stuff that deals with that. But the point is that when we go back to 1:1a, in the beginning was the word. The word is identified here as being eternal. And, of course, Greg Stafford tries to argue, well, there's different beginnings. He comes up with all sorts of different beginnings to try to get around this particular assertion. But leaving the heretics aside for just a moment, in the beginning was the word points us back to the eternal nature of this word, this logos, that the reader of the Gospel of John is going to be hearing more about once we get down to verses 14 and 18, where the logos becomes flesh and is the one who reveals the Father. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, proston theon. Now, here there is a distinction made between the logos and theon. And in this case, it theon and theos, you might say, well, are those different words, different meanings? No. Both have the same root. One is in the accusative, one is in the nominative, and they're referring to the same thing. But the word was with God. There was a relationship, and what we're going to see when we look at the prologue of John, and we look at it as an entire thing. When I debated Greg Stafford on this subject, he wanted to divorce John 1:1 from John 1:1 through 18, and that's not how you do exegesis. You do not honestly deal with what an author is attempting to say by cutting the beginning off of his introduction. In fact, when it's very clear that his introduction is meant to be taken as a whole, when 1:1 is parallel to 1:18, if you don't take that into consideration, you cannot even begin to claim that you're honestly dealing with the text itself. And so he wanted to isolate this and wanted to get into an argument about mass and count nouns, and completely lose the audience. And I simply would not allow that to happen. I kept drawing him back to the context and the fact that you have to read these things in their context. And what you find with the Greg Staffords and the people he's trained and the people who've sort of attempted to, hitch a ride with him. I'm sorry?
Be his fans.
Try to be his what?
His fans.
Well, not just his fans, but especially in the internet, what you've got are a lot of would-be Jehovah's Witness apologists who... Now, I don't know what's going to happen now in light of the September Kingdom Ministry thing that has sort of put a clamp on these guys. Who knows what Brooklyn's going to do? There's all the things changing back there. But there are a lot of folks who have adopted his methodology, and they find the internet to be a very safe place to basically engage in their warfare because there's a certain level of anonymity in it. And so there's a lot of them running around, and what they really do in essence is they will study one particular text. They'll grab all sorts, any type of argumentation that can be derived. For example, mass and count nouns, even though I don't believe that Mr. Stafford shows a great deal of understanding of what those issues are. Still at the same time, he throws this stuff out there, writes huge, just massive amounts of verbiage on these particular subjects. And then other people pick up on that, and most Christians just do not have time in their life to even begin to interact with what in the world he has to say. So this is what they're doing, and what they do is they'll focus upon these key texts, and they'll read all sorts of stuff and throw all this stuff out. But if you took them away from the key text on the deity of Christ and asked them to translate just a passage of Scripture that has nothing to do with the deity of Christ, nothing to do with the key issues of Jehovah's Witnesses, they wouldn't be able to touch it because they don't actually read the language. All they've done is learned what's in these particular texts, and when you drag them outside of that area, they're lost. They have no idea how to deal with any of that kind of stuff. And they won't translate in accordance with the self-made rules they make up to try to get around the key texts on the deity of Christ.
Right.
You know, and so I have a hard time respecting that kind of idea as being real exegesis. But anyway, the point being that the second clause differentiates between the word and God and says there's a relationship between the two. So the big issue is, what is being said in 1:1c? Now, Dr. Hartley, I'm going to refer you to, I'm not going to bore the audience to tears with a discussion of mass and count nouns. What you want to do is you want to get hold of Dr. Hartley's materials on mass and count nouns. I'm sure they're on the internet. I can't pull them up right now. I've pulled them up before. We're talking about some pretty in-depth stuff here. Dr. Hartley is a bright guy. If you use Google on our website, because I'm not sure if our search engine works yet or not, I have linked to some of his books that he has put out. He really knows his stuff, and he has taken Stafford apart on this particular issue. And Hartley knows the mass and count nouns stuff. He's on the cutting edge of research in the syntactical area in this subject. And he, unlike most scholars in those areas, has actually taken time to interact with the things that that Stafford has said, because Stafford and his followers like to quote people like Hartley or Wallace and things like that. And so at least Dan Wallace and Dr. Hartley and others have taken the time to respond to some of the misuses of their materials and things like that. But to make a long story short, the question that the believer needs to address in the third clause of John 1:1 is this saying that there is an equal sign between the Word and God, especially in light of 1:1b that says, and the Word was with God? What is the nature of the term God here? And of course, the majority, and I certainly think that this is, as you read the rest of the New Testament, as you translate the rest of the New Testament, this makes perfect sense. What is being said, and in fact, Dan Wallace suggests this in his grammar, is that maybe a better translation, at least on the meaning side, not so much on the actual translation side, doesn't flow very well. But the word was as to his nature deity. That is, the anarthrous pre-verbal predicate nominative, it occurs before the verb, means that it's describing the nature of the Logos, not identifying the person of the Logos.
Right.
The Logos is going to be identified for us in John 1:14.
Right.
And then the relationship of the Father and the Son, who is being described here in 1:1, that terminology will have been introduced by the end of the prologue, and that's it's something called book ending, where you basically repeat what you started with at the end.
Right.
And the relationship between the two of them will have been explained and expanded upon, and in verse 1:18 it is said that this monogenes theos, this unique God, God the one and only Son who is God, is what I think is the best translation there. This is the one who makes him known, who explains him, who exegetes him, who reveals him to the world, and the only one who can do that is one who is theos in his nature in John 1:1.
Right.
But as far as Stafford's issues there, like I said, the best thing that I could direct you to would be Dr. Hartley's materials on that. If for some strange reason you putting in Hartley plus mass and count nouns or something along those lines does not pull up that material, then drop us a line. I can find the URL for you, because I know within the past 2 months or so I was looking at it, and I was able to pull it up on the first, I think it was on the first list, and they brought it up. So it's very in-depth stuff, and the only way to follow it in any meaningful fashion is to already know the language and already know all the syntactical Greek language that you need to have to be able to discuss those things.
Right. Okay, well, yeah, it seems like with Stafford, he, like you said, one, he's trying to isolate one text, not take it in light of the whole, and it's almost like he's saying that, no, he means he's God-like, not equal with God the Father.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the thing the big question that will always be hanging out there, and that maybe we will finally get a meaningful answer to someday, and maybe someday soon, is what is the Watchtower Society going to do with Greg Stafford? Because his rather open henotheism, that is, he's very clear, very open in the debate, and the two debates that he's done, and if he's done any since he debated me, I'm not aware of it. He may have, don't know. But certainly in my debate and the debate that he did before that, he was very clear and open in promoting a form of henotheism. And the Watchtower Society has always been rather, concerned to emphasize that they are monotheists.
Right.
Now, I think that he's certainly got a point as far as what Jehovah's Witness theology has always led to. But one of the reasons that the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society has not allowed outside apologists to flourish in the past, and back in the 1970s, they kicked Nelson Hurley out for publishing a self-publishing a book defending the Watchtower Society. Why? Why do they call that running ahead of the brethren? Because they need to control their apologetic methodology in Brooklyn. They need to be able to have control over what their people are seeing. They don't want their people reading my books. They don't want their people reading Ron Rhodes' books or Duane Mignogna's books or David Reed's books. They don't want them going out and doing these things, and clearly that's what Stafford's doing. And if they see quotes of us in Stafford's book, what's the difference? You know, they're still getting the same stuff. And so they have wanted to control their apologetic methodology so that when they do need to change 1914 to something else or de-emphasize it or slowly get rid of it or whatever, they can do it at their own pace in their own way. And having apologists out there drawing attention to certain things they may not want to draw attention to really causes them a big problem. So was the September Kingdom Ministry that came out, was that the society reasserting its control, saying, hey, we've let these people go too far? I don't know. Who knows? Stafford certainly has far more insight into those things than I do. But individuals like him most certainly are an anomaly. And the average Jehovah's Witness you're going to run into at the doorstep is not going to be as open about saying that Jesus is a godlike one or that he is called God and all these other things the way that Stafford is. And so it used to be, there was a day when I would emphasize the fact, and this is still true to a large part, but it's breaking down. There was a day when we went out to Mesa, and when we'd witness the Mormons, even the Mormon kids said the same things. They knew what Mormonism believed, and they knew what Mormonism taught. And that's changed. That has changed. You can talk to adults out there, if you get a chance to talk to anybody more, thanks to the King James Only Fundamentalist Wackos out there. But if you can, there's a much wider spectrum of belief being expressed under Mormonism. And so for a long time, I contrasted that with Jehovah's Witnesses, where at least when you talk to Jehovah's Witnesses about central core issues, you always got the same answers. And that made sense. I mean, they're all sitting there reading the same magazine, and they all sing the same hymns in whatever language they're in all over the world on every Sunday, and they're all sitting there answering the exact same questions in the exact same watchtower issues at the exact same time. That tends to create a fair amount of unanimity. And then long comes Greg Stafford. And now, especially when you're online, it would seem to me there's a greater probability that you're going to run into a Staffordite apologist in an AOL chat room or a Yahoo chat room or a web board than you are a plain old standard Jehovah's Witness. And so now you've got one spin on their theology that you encounter in the internet world, the cyber world, the pal talk world. I can't believe I said that. Somebody, could you get me a drink, Rich? I have a terrible taste in my mouth. Oh, it's terrible. And then the actual Jehovah's Witness standing at your door, or at the business, or wherever else it might be. And so there's a little bit of a spectrum developing there where you're going to get a different, you know, kind of viewpoint expressed within those two contexts.
Right. It seems to me like if John wanted to imply that Jesus Christ was less than the Father, he would have either worded the last clause differently or just used a different word altogether, like theopathos.
Well, you know, it's hard to I really hesitate when we get into the he would have used such a term type thing, because theotetos is not a term. Theot is not a stem found in John. As you're probably aware, it only occurs twice, and they're both Pauline uses. So while the term is available generally in the New Testament era, to assume or to even suggest that it would have been something that would have suggested itself to John or something like that, I'm really leery about things like that. I think that John's gospel, especially John's gospel, provides such a clear context that it's really hard to avoid the contextual meaning of what John is. You have to cut John into little pieces and not allow everything in John to come together. And I've used this illustration before. It's a little bit like my talk with Mormons about the first vision. I present all this information. I was editing an article for the CRA Journal a couple days ago that I've written on the first vision. And there's so much information that demonstrates the first vision story is the result of...
Can't hear you, James.
Can't hear me?
No.
I have...
Must be my phone.
Must be your phone, because nothing's changed on this end. Sorry about that. Would you rather listen online then? I guess we'll have to... guess we'll have to have Stephen listen online. So anyway, too late. I don't follow that, but anyway, never mind. I can't follow your hand signals there. No, I took him off. I took him off because couldn't hear me anymore. So the only way to get him to listen to the rest of the comments is to listen to the webcast. So anyway, the point being, there's so much factual information about the first vision, and what they do is they take all that information, they put it out in a line, and then you try to find a way around this one, and then you try to find a way around the next one, and then you try to find a way around the next one. And the illustration I've used is it's like saying that theoretically, you could avoid every single rock in an avalanche. I mean, theoretically. You know, you could plot this rock, and then I move over here, and then I plot that rock, and I move over here. The problem is, truth is like an avalanche. It doesn't come at you one stone at a time. They all come at you at the same time. And it's the Gospel of John the same way. If you take it as a whole, its testimony to the deity of Christ is so clear, that's why liberals hate it. The liberals see it. The people who actually don't believe the Bible's inspired, they see it, they recognize it, and that's why they reject it, because no one could have really ever made these claims, because we start off the presupposition that whatever Jesus was, he wasn't who the church says he was down through the ages. So, therefore, John must have been making all this stuff up. Even the liberals recognize, hey, you take John as a whole, John's teaching is clear. But what people like Greg Stafford, they do, they try to take it one rock at a time. And truth is like an avalanche. You can't do it that way. All right, let's continue on with have no idea how to. Let's try race. Is that race correct?
Yes.
Yes, sir. What can we do for you?
I had a question regarding Matthew 27:46, and it's basically in regards to in what sense was Christ forsaken by God? I had a discussion with a guy, and we were talking about this passage, and my understanding has always been that, yes, there was a sense in which Christ was forsaken by the Father on the cross. This kind of, it was a result of a teaching by R.C. Sproul on DVD, and he kind of went into detail and was talking about this, and this other gentleman didn't agree. He couldn't understand how the Father could turn his back or forsake the Son.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's a messianic psalm from Psalm 22.
Yep.
And the guy that I was talking to, he said if you go on with Psalm 22, it will actually lead you away from the idea that Christ was forsaken, because he said in Psalm 22, he says, "For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, and he has not hidden his face from him,
mm-hmm.
but has heard when he cried to him."
Yep.
And he said, based on that, he didn't see how that would make sense. And then he also quoted John 16:32, and John 16:32 says, "Behold, the hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and will leave me alone, yet I am not alone. The Father is with me."
Mm-hmm.
So his argument was that Christ wasn't forsaken. He just felt forsaken, but in fact, he truly was never forsaken.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get your input on that.
Okay. Well, if you want to follow up on this, there is a not extensive but fairly lengthy, at least paragraph-length footnote on Matthew 27:46 in my book, The Forgotten Trinity, where basically I said everything your friend said, and I would agree with him. I think there are a large number, and I do this with a little bit of fear and trepidation, but there are a large number of very godly men who have preached some real stem-winder sermons on the holiness of God illustrated in his turning his back upon his Son when he becomes sin for us, and all these other things, all based upon Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Mm-hmm.
I had a professor in Bible college, Dr. D.C. Martin, and Dr. Martin was a brilliant man. He was a great guy. Passed away a number of years ago, and I miss him a lot. I learned a tremendous amount from him, and most of the time that I learned from him is when he was stepping on my traditions. Uh-huh. And skewering my presuppositions, and this was one of them that he skewered, and so I give credit where credit is due at this point. I think your friend is exactly right. I do not see anywhere, despite the fact that some great men have preached some real moving sermons on this,
uh-huh.
I see no evidence, especially in the key texts like in the book of Hebrews, that would surely, if there was anywhere where you would have a discussion of this taking place, you'd find it there in Hebrews. But nowhere do any of the New Testament writers pick up on anything. Instead, what you have is a constant emphasis upon how the Father is pleased with the self-sacrifice of the Son, and He accepts these things, and the unity of the Father and Son in bringing these things together. And so, as I considered those things, you put together the fact that, yes, this is from Psalm 22:1, and the Psalter, of course, is the hymn book of the early church. And if I were to break out in song right now and start singing Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound, I would not have to sing the entire hymn to communicate the meaning of that hymn to my audience, because everybody in my audience knows what I'm talking about, because everyone knows that hymn. And in the same way, if you say Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, those who are steeped in the Psalter know exactly what you're referring to, and it's going to bring to mind the entirety of that psalm, which is not only just a messianic psalm, but it is a messianic psalm that likewise speaks of the suffering of that servant, and it speaks of the vindication of that servant as you read the whole thing. And so, given the fact that Jesus is upon a cross where breathing is extremely difficult and painful, you would hardly expect him to be breaking into song with the entirety of Psalm 22, nor would you need to do so in light of the fact that the Jews would understand where this came from. It's the only place in the Psalter where this language is utilized. Secondly, it really raises some tremendous issues for me, that at the very point of the Son's greatest obedience to the Father, that you would, in essence, have a disruption in the Godhead. That's what is really being posited when you talk about the Father turning his back upon the Son or anything else. And as your friend pointed out from John chapter 16, and as I would point out from the rest of the sayings upon the cross, there is no follow-up to this in the sense of Jesus showing any acknowledgement that now the Father is somehow far away from him. In fact, if we put them in some sort of an order, the next words, at least provided by the Synoptic Gospels, would be, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. That's second person. That's direct address. That's someone who's there. And so you'd have to posit that, well, the Father turned his back just at that point, and then by the time Jesus says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, now he's turned back again or something along those lines, which I just don't see any evidence for or any reason to believe that the very point of the Son's greatest obedience, there is this disruption and this turning of the back, which, of course, is not a biblical phrase. There's nothing that raises that type of an issue at all. And so it seems to me that since the cross flows from the very decree of the Father and the love of the Father, and it is entered into voluntarily by the Son, and there is no emphasis or no discussion or picking up of this concept whatsoever anywhere else within the New Testament, that while it's, like I said, has caused some folks to preach some real emotional sermons, I don't see any reason to believe it. I think there is a much better way of seeing this as a citation of Psalm 22, bringing the entire psalm before people's minds. The person who's observing this and who's thinking sees the servant, sees the fulfillment in what's going on in Psalm 22 with this one, and then that inevitably leads you then to the vindication at the end of Psalm 22 of the servant that likewise the Messiah himself is going to experience. And so, I would say that your friend is correct at that point.
I think RC seemed to build up to a point as almost that there was a point in time where there was the imputation of sin, and at that point when the sin was imputed upon the Son, he was the most despicable, the most obscene thing in the world that would have ever been. And at that point, the Father, I know you said this is not really biblical terms, but turned his back. And then I think he almost hinted at the idea that that was the cause of the darkness, the Father turning the lights out during that moment of his forsaking the Son. And I guess one part that I always kind of struggled with is the idea that it is taught that it was the holiness of God doesn't allow him to have anything to do with sin. But I guess at the same time, for you to say that, you would have to almost in some sense deny the deity of Christ, because he would be, unless you would divide it up into his human nature aspect, I mean, you would still have, I think you would still have the same problem to deal with even with Christ if you said that, though.
Well, yeah, like I said, there have been some very imaginative and very strong sermons preached, and I'm not interested in, you know, trying to contradict anybody. I just simply think that on a theological, exegetical basis, that you run into some pretty serious problems when you attempt to assert that there is, in essence, a disruption of the Godhead here, and the eternal fellowship that has always existed between the Father and the Son is somehow broken in some sort of wrathful anger at this particular point in time. And yes, I've always heard, grew up hearing the repeated statement that, well, the Father cannot look upon sin. Well, yes and no. He looks upon the world all the time and sees sin. So that what that means is he doesn't look upon sin and have fellowship with it. But again, when Jesus takes upon the sins of the world, he's not sent to hell for eternity either. So there's something going on here that is much more than meets the eye. And so I do not want to in any way try to say that we can plumb the entire depth of the mystery of what takes place on the cross of Calvary. And certainly there is something that causes the Lord Jesus to say, if there is any other way, let this cup pass from me. And so I'm not minimizing in any way Paul's statement, he became sin for us. All those things are completely true. But I don't see how any of that necessitates the insertion of an unbiblical phraseology about turning back upon or anything else, and reading into a citation from the Psalter something that would actually disrupt the flow of Psalm 22, because the actual sufferings of Christ come after that. And so not before that. You know, if this is in the middle somewhere, okay, maybe you might have a case at that point, but still, there's no New Testament teaching that picks up on this. And so I'm just trying to be consistent with the kind of theology that I do in light of the abuse of Christian teaching in the apologetic context that I see all the time. And I just want to be consistent in applying the same rules all the way along. And if someone says, well, you know, is that a New Testament teaching? You go, well, the New Testament writers didn't seem to say anything about it. They didn't seem to pick up on it. And in every other context, we would look at the psalm that is being quoted from the Psalter and what it's communicating. And I think we need to do that, too. I think we miss that if we don't see the connection to Psalm 22. But once we see the connection to Psalm 22, we don't have to follow through with all the separation of the Father-Son type stuff that is, again, very, very common. Some big, big, big names, but I just disagree.
This question may be off the wall, so please excuse me if it is. But is it possible that we could say that Christ bore the full measure of the penalty of sin if there wasn't a separation that took place?
Well, ask yourself this question: given that it was not eternity, that was the wrath of eternity that was being experienced, what does that say? I mean, we are not told the specific mechanism whereby Jesus becomes sin and everything that involves. And people want to try to pry into those things, and I don't know that we necessarily should. In many instances, what God's truth does is it delimits lines that say the truth is within this and it's not outside here, but it doesn't necessarily give us everything we'd like to know even within those lines. And so when it tells us that Jesus Christ is the God-man, there's all sorts of speculations and questions we'd like to ask about, well, what's a God-man like when he's 12 or when he's 10 or, you know, things like that. The Bible doesn't tell us, and only the Gnostics in the second century decided to, you know, start delving into those things. In the same way, we know that he who knew no sin was made sin in our behalf, we might become righteous of God in him. And we know that the offering that he makes propitiates the wrath of God. And we know that because of this, by having faith in Christ, we can have peace with God and the imputation of his righteousness. But the specific mechanism whereby there is some kind of one-to-one correspondence, there isn't a one-to-one correspondence. You have one taking the place of many. You have one act of righteousness justifying the many. And all the speculation that we can try to throw out there isn't really, I think, going to answer the question. Could there be a true propitiation without abandonment? Well, is abandonment necessarily part and parcel of what it means for God to be, to God the Father to accept the sacrifice of the Son so that his justice is fulfilled? Is that what we're trying to argue? And if so, why? Would it not follow that length of time would have to then enter into this as well? Would there have to be a temporality? You know, there's all sorts of questions like that I don't know that the Spirit of God has given a sufficient basis upon which to answer those things. And from my perspective, I think it's far better to address this issue exegetically within the key context and be able to say, okay, here's where Hebrews chapter 7 tells us that because of Christ being our high priest and because of what he does in the work of intercession, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw nigh unto God by him. Okay, there's positive didactic teaching. And there's so much of that that we should be satisfied with that. I sometimes get worried about folks who want to sit around going, yeah, fine. Hey, I wonder about this over here, you know. Those are the folks who, you know, I've seen them in the churches, and they're the ones you worry about. They really, really are. They get tired of the same old after a while and move on to the next show. So, that's sort of where I come down on those things.
So would there be a resource? I do have the Forgotten Trinity, and I will look that up. Is there a resource that you would recommend that would go into this, because I
go into
my reading, it seems like this is the minority position, the one that you're promoting.
Well, when we say minority position, as far as the other viewpoint is very popular. But There's two ways in which something could be a minority position. Because the issue is discussed openly and the majority of people disagree, or the majority position is the default tradition because of preaching and exposure, but there's almost no discussion whatsoever about the merits of that position versus the minority position. In other words, the majority of those who hold the majority don't know what the minority is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the situation we're dealing with here. In other words, I grew up, until I was in college, I had never heard anyone challenge anything on that subject. Mm-hmm. I did not know that there was a controversy. So while I would have been a part of the majority, I would have been a part of the majority by default, not by choice, not by I know what the issues are and I've chosen, you know, I've studied it and I've come to a conclusion and I'm in the majority. And so in this situation, while I would say that I'm in the minority viewpoint, I don't think the vast majority of those who are in the majority viewpoint have ever even recognized that there was any issue here at all. Let me give you another example that's actually fairly closely related. Is the fact that the statement when Jesus is upon the cross and he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, that's a textual variant. And in fact, there's good reason for not believing that that textual variant's original. I didn't know that all the way through seminary. Never mentioned. Didn't know it. Had in fact, I would say it was 2003 before I even became aware of that fact. Now, that really is important, but it's not necessarily something that everyone is aware of, and therefore you could look at all these people who have preached long sermons on Father forgive them, they know what to do, but how many of them actually bothered to look down at the bottom of the Greek text, if they even had a Greek text near them, and go, oh, well, look at that. Hadn't thought about that, you know? And so that's an illustration that I think speaks to this issue as well. As to resources, I don't know. Just off the top of my head, again, it's not an area where I, you know, go out and once I found someone who's preached the other way, I attack them after the service and beat them over the head with my Greek New Testament or something. You know, I don't do that. But I really don't know what to refer you to. I mean, I would assume that the majority of meaningful exegetical commentaries are going to probably focus upon the Psalm 22 issue, but unfortunately they may not even go into the theological issues. So I'm not sure what to direct you to. I mean, the folks going on the cruise are reading The Death of Death, and they're reading Owen's material on the vindication of God's justice, but as far as modern resources, I really don't know what I could direct you to. Sorry.
Okay. Is this not something that would probably come up in the debate on the cross with Shabir Ali? Is this probably not something that they would even address? Or
well, I think it's definitely something that you need to be aware of. And I'm thinking back over all of Shabir's discussions, and I could be wrong here, but I don't recall it really coming up. But believe me, if it does, I'll be ready for it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you very much for taking my call.
All right. Thanks a lot. God bless.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Wow. Two calls, and that took us to within 1 minute and 40 seconds of the end of the program. Well, okay. All right. I talked about Summers Professor. But I don't think I'm going to have any opportunity to start the Shabir Ali thing here. I suppose I could just, you know, do, you know, something like, oh, it's not even on anyways. Oh, well. I tried to start it, but you didn't have the computer on anyhow, so it doesn't make any difference. You did now, but it's too late. The humor is gone. You just shot it. It's gone. So, and you don't really look like you care a whole lot one way or the other, actually. You're just going, you're stretching it out, aren't you? Yes, I know. So we won't have an opportunity to go to the Shabir Ali or the Bible Answer Man thing because we have less than 1 minute left. But keep an eye on the blog this weekend because I'm going to have a chat with Summer and say, hey, should we just flush this grade anyways? No, we ain't going to do that. Let me tell you something right now. We ain't flushing that grade. And I am going to be sending an MP3 player with her to every class from now on, and I'm recording every lecture from now on, and I'm keeping examples of every lecture from now on, and I'm going to keep everything she submits to that class, and if what I expect to happen happens, I'm going to be meeting with some people in the administration. You had better believe it, because I'm going to tell you, just not going to let it happen. It's wrong. So watch over the weekend. See if something appears. That'll tell you one way or the other. And let's see, next week, as far as I know, Lord willing, we'll be here. But something's coming up real quick, folks. It's called the cruise. It's called the conference. It's called the class. It is called the debate in Seattle with Shabir Ali on the atonement. It is only a month away. It's the 19th and today's 20th, so it's less than a month away, but it's 4 weeks from tomorrow night. Let's put it that way is how that's going to work out. So it's coming. Keep praying for us, and we'll see you next week on The Dividing Line. God bless.
New Reformation Day. It's a center.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.